Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is August 27, 1978, and this is my AUDIO LETTER No. 37. As the warm, lazy days of August 1978 draw to a close, summer is on the wane for the United States of America. With every passing day now, the sun shines less brightly on our land, and already the signs are all around us pointing to a harsh and early winter. But instead of preparing, most of us are still just trying to squeeze the last bit of pleasure out of the little bit of summer that remains. These things are true, my friends, not only in the literal sense of the weather, but also in the figurative, historical sense. On all sides, we in the United States are playing games with ourselves. We prefer to fool ourselves with comfortable lies than to open our eyes to the brilliant light of the truth, and our secret rulers are quick to assist us in deluding ourselves through every avenue imaginable. So it is, for example, that as the American dollar is dying en route to worldwide monetary chaos, luxurious conferences on the situation are springing up in the United States. More and more people are attending these conferences, expecting to hear what is wrong and what to do. But increasingly they see only the same stale establishment faces wherever they go, and they hear about everything except the real reasons for our economic woes. So the attendees leave as they came, ignorant of the facts and unable to protect themselves. But the lure of big-sounding names and posh accommodations is powerful, and many of the same people show up at one conference after another to be hoodwinked over and over again. The items that fill the alleged news these days are also a study in distraction and distortion. For example, tremendous publicity was focused earlier this month on the American balloonists who successfully crossed the Atlantic for the first time. But hovering over battle stations worldwide are the space age successors to balloons and dirigibles, the Soviet Cosmospheres. And about these devices, which are a matter of life and death to you, there's a total news blackout. Yesterday, a major event took place on the spiritual battleground between East and West. It dominated the news, and yet you were not told what it really meant. I refer to the lightning-fast election of a new pope who calls himself John Paul I. In recent years, many changes have been introduced in Roman Catholic worship. For example, it used to be that every Mass in the free world ended with a prayer for the conversion of Russia. But today, as this prayer is being answered in Russia, it is heard no more in the Catholic Mass. In 1954, the Chase Manhattan Bank became the custodian of the enormous business holdings of the Vatican through tax-exempt trust accounts. Since that time, the Church has been losing its sovereignty and is today highly politicized. Soon millions of Roman Catholics will be overjoyed to see the Church shifting its policies to an active anti-Russian stance under the guise of anti-communism. But in reality, the Rockefellers want to enlist 700 million Catholics into the war against Russia. As I have explained in my latest two AUDIO letters, the self-styled spiritual communists who run the Kremlin today regard the atheistic communism known as Bolshevism as their number one enemy. And now the Pope himself is dominated by Bolshevik influences. But the most crisis-oriented person in the world now is Jimmy Carter. The only hint of this in the news is his disengagement from day-to-day non-crisis situations and his lack of concern over disastrous public opinion polls. Jimmy Carter is a man waiting impatiently for his hour to come, an hour of crisis. He spends large amounts of time away from the White House, while medication and other measures are being used to keep him in an artificial, abnormal state of mind. because no man in his right mind could do what Jimmy Carter has promised to do for his masters. When the time comes, Jimmy Carter will be called upon to push the button to launch a nuclear first strike against the Soviet Union. The consequences, my friends, will be unthinkable. But in his present artificial euphoria, Jimmy Carter can hardly wait to do it. It was only last month that I first made public the American shift to a first strike strategy. But the preparations to carry out this strategy are progressing at a feverish pace. Many pieces of the military jigsaw puzzle are not yet in place, however, and the Soviet Union has already learned the plan through the efforts of their own KGB. The Russians have their own countdown in progress toward the first strike, as I explained 4 months ago in AUDIO LETTER 33. Meanwhile, they are working fast to thwart the American plan. Regardless of which side succeeds in striking first, the American people and to a lesser extent the entire West will lose. The pathetic civil defense television programs which are being rushed into production now to show just before a nuclear war will do us very little good, my friends. Only if you know the plan will you have any chance to see what is happening in time to protect yourself. There's no timetable, my friends, but we may well have seen our last summer at peace before nuclear war won. My three topics for today are: Topic number 1, the Middle East road to an American first strike. Topic number 2, Russia's Asian counter-strategy for a first strike. And topic number 3, the era of the American refugee. Topic number 1. For nearly a year now, the controlled Carter administration has been in a concealed state of crisis on the road to nuclear war won. It was 11 months ago to the day, September 27, 1977, that America lost the secret battle of the Harvest Moon in space. Suddenly America's ace in the hole for the coming war, the secret beam weapons base on the Moon, was gone. As I revealed in detail that month in AUDIO LETTER 26, the most decisive battle of the 20th century had just taken place. Our secret rulers reacted at first with stark fear and near panic. At first they pretended to capitulate to the Russian Harvest Moon ultimatum for surrender by means of SALT II disarmament. Then, as the initial shock wore off, they began stalling tactics to hold off the Russians while they tried to figure out what to do. Meanwhile, the Russian Navy swarmed into attack positions around the United States during October 1977. At the same time, the Soviet Union wasted no time in following up on their Harvest Moon space victory. Manned Cosmos Interceptor killer satellites, using charged particle beam weapons, began clearing the skies of American spy satellites. Having evicted America from the Moon, the Soviet Union also activated a moon flight program to seize the Moon for its own particle beam weapons installations, of which there are now 7 on the near side. And to ruin any chance that the United States might send more men to the Moon, our secret orbital way station in the military moon program was destroyed. On October 18, 1977, as I reported in AUDIO LETTER 27, Skylab was shot down over the United States by a Cosmos Interceptor killer satellite, and with it went the 5 American astronauts who were secretly aboard at the time. Since that time, the pace of events has been very fast, as I've revealed for you month by month. But the first strike strategy, which has now been adopted by the United States, first began to surface 9 months ago in November 1977. There were 3 separate developments, and they took place with blinding speed, all within a week's time. First, there was a so-called Sadat Peace Initiative, quote-unquote, to Israel. It began on November 14 during television interviews, of all things, in which President Sadat of Egypt and Prime Minister Begin of Israel committed themselves to a face-to-face meeting. Only a week later, Sadat was already returning home from his rush trip to Jerusalem, which generated euphoria on all sides. But as I told you then, Sadat's actions were destined to lead to war, not peace, and now the Middle East is approaching the boiling point. Like the Sadat trip to Israel, the second major development also began on November 14. On that day, the Shah of Iran arrived in Washington on a rush visit, which ended 2 days later. No reason was given publicly for his hurry-up trip, but as I told you then, it was linked to the startling events in the Middle East. It was a busy week, my friends, because sandwiched in between the Shah's trip to Washington and Sadat's trip to Israel was the third major event. On November 18, the Voice of America broadcast a threat of preemptive war against Russia, for which I quoted that month in AUDIO LETTER 28. That threat was premature, a bluff brought to nothing by the Soviet Navy, which swarmed into attack positions again. But it was a taste of things to come. 4 months ago, in April 1978, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance went to Moscow in response to a renewal of the Harvest Moon Salt Surrender Ultimatum of 6 months earlier. While there, he was provided with crucial information by the Korean Airliner Intelligence Mission, which I detailed for you in AUDIO LETTER 33. And as soon as he returned to Washington, our secret rulers decided to implement contingency plans for a first-strike nuclear strategy. Since that time, the United States and the Soviet Union have been in a race against time, each trying to beat the other into position to launch a decisive surprise attack. In this topic, I will outline the American strategy. With that in mind, you will find it much easier to understand the Russian strategy when I outline that in topic number 2. The strategic goal in the new American first strike strategy is to undo the total Russian military domination of space, which began 11 months ago. We often hear these days about our so-called triad of strategic weapons, meaning ICBMs, missile-launching submarines, and bombers. The Russians, of course, possess a similar triad, which in fact is now more powerful than our own. But today the Soviet Union possesses, in addition, a space triad of strategic weapons, and the central objective of the American surprise attack plan is to bring to ruin the Russian space triad. One leg of the space triad is the Moon, which bristles with Russian particle beam weapons. They can blast almost any spot on Earth within the course of any 24-hour period. Whenever the Moon is above the horizon where you are subject to practically instantaneous attack from the Moon. The second leg of the Soviet space triad is the fleet of Cosmos Interceptor killer satellites in orbit around the Earth. These space-age sentinels are manned and armed with charged particle beam weapons with which to blast all non-Soviet military satellites out of existence. Months ago, they completed the task of wiping out all of America's early warning and spy satellites, making necessary the Korean Airliner Intelligence Mission of 4 months ago. Now they remain on patrol, ready to nip in the bud any attempt by the United States to reestablish a military toehold in space. The third leg of the Russian space triad is the fleet of Cosmospheres, the electrogravitic hovering weapons platforms called the anti-war machine by the Kremlin. As I discussed last March in AUDIO LETTER 32, the late great General Thomas Power gave a public warning 13 years ago about the coming threat from these platforms, but he was ignored. The United States could have developed these platforms too, but did not. And now the Russians have deployed them over strategic locations worldwide and in great numbers. Armed with charged particle beam weapons, they can produce weather modification effects by means of defocused blasts into the upper atmosphere. In the process, they also generate violent air blasts, which were heard last winter over the United States. But they can also focus their particle beams in order to vaporize targets on the ground, at sea, or in the air. So long as the Russian space triad remains intact, The West has no hope of victory or even a draw in a war with the Soviet Union. But our secret rulers cannot shake their dream of world domination. So instead of taking measures that could prevent war, they are trying to position themselves to smash the Russian space triad. Even if they succeed, a furious and massive Russian counterattack is a certainty, and our secret rulers know it. But they believe there is a chance that the conflict will finally sputter out into a stalemate if the Russian space triad can be neutralized. And beginning from the smoking ruins of this stalemate, they think they will be able to start over again about as well off as the Soviet Union. The price of achieving this desired stalemate has already been studied with the aid of think tank computers. If the American first strike turns out to be a spectacular success, there could be 255 million fatalities in the United States, the Soviet Union, and Great Britain, plus a few million in selected other target areas. But even in this best case, however, more than half the casualties will take place in the United States, which, unlike Russia, is naked in terms of civil defense. If things do not go so well, though, the computers say that up to 350 million people may die before the stalemate point is reached. The United States has no effective means by which to attack the Soviet space triad directly. But there is one weak point which is shared by all three legs of the Russian space triad, and that weak point is logistics. The cosmonauts who man the particle beam bases on the Moon depend for their lives on regular supply missions from Earth. Likewise, the Cosmos interceptors in Earth orbit can remain operational only so long as their crews can be rotated and resupplied from Earth. And the Cosmospheres, too, require periodic servicing and resupply in order to keep operating. The centerpiece of the American first strike, my friends, is to be a knockout punch at Russia's space logistics network. The plan is to destroy all four Soviet Cosmodromes, plus the Cosmosphere installations in central Siberia, in a fast, well-coordinated blow. Immediately following this initial blow, there is to follow a full-scale nuclear attack by the American triad of ICBMs, Poseidon missiles, and bombers. The key weapon to be used in the attack on Russia's space bases is a secret weapon which until now has never assumed great importance. For a change, it is a weapon which the United States did develop while Russia did not. It is a strange hybrid machine called a submersible aircraft, or subcraft for short. A subcraft is an airplane which can land on water, change its configuration, dive and travel underwater like a submarine. Then, near its destination, it can reverse the process and seem to come from nowhere as it attacks the target from the air. Subcraft development began in the United States in the early 1960s. Those available today do not dive very deep, and they are not very fast, either underwater or in the air. Their strength lies in their ability to sneak past enemy defenses. Submerged, they have surprisingly long endurance and range due to a small nuclear power plant derived from space technology. They can travel through shallow coastal waters where sonar detection is all but impossible, and their relatively small size and quiet operation also help reduce the chances of detection. In the air, they duck under radar by flying at treetop height, and they are so quiet that they attract little or no attention en route to the target. The critical role of subcraft in the American first strike plan is a result of geography. They are not involved in the part of the attack plan directed at the Cosmosphere bases in central Siberia, but they are the key ingredient in the planned attack on Russia's four Cosmodromes. The real estate of three countries is critical to the first strike plan. The countries are Norway, Iran, and China. Staging areas in all three must be used if the first strike plan is to succeed in knocking out the Russian space triad. From the fjords of northern Norway, American subcraft are to head eastward underwater, straight into the jaws of the Russian bear. They will have to make their way past Murmansk, which teems with Russian submarines. Continuing onward, they will follow the shoreline of the Kola Peninsula, around and into the White Sea. Then they are to penetrate southwest into the White Sea, to the vicinity of Onega before surfacing at night. From there it is a short flight of little more than 100 miles to their target, the Plesetsk Cosmodrome. If the plan works, night will be turned to day, as the Cosmodrome is consumed by nuclear fireballs. For the other three Cosmodrome attacks, Iran is to provide the staging areas along the south end of the Caspian Sea. Two subcraft contingents are to travel submerged roughly half the length of the Caspian, then fly east across the Ust-Irt Plateau to the Aral Sea. There they are to submerge again and proceed to the northeast side until it is time to attack. The third subcraft contingent from Iran is to travel northward the entire length of the Caspian and then lie in wait for the moment of attack. In the attack itself, the subcraft squadron in the north end of the Caspian will surface at night. Heading northwest, they will fly roughly 250 miles to attack the Kapustin-Yar Cosmodrome east of Stalingrad. Meanwhile, subcraft will surface in the Aral Sea and fly northeast. The first group will head for the original Baikonur Cosmodrome some 250 to 300 miles away. Shortly afterward, the other group will take off to attack the Tyuratam Cosmodrome barely 100 miles distant. If all goes according to plan, the Cosmodromes at Kapustin-Yar, Baikonur, and Tyuratam will erupt into nighttime nuclear fireballs at the same time as the Plesetsk Cosmodrome far to the north meets the same fate. In this manner, the subcraft attacks from Norway and Iran are intended to cripple two of the three legs of the Russian space triad, the Moon and the orbiting Cosmos interceptors. That leaves only the Cosmospheres. The Cosmosphere bases are located in central Siberia, far from any body of water that would be useful to submersible aircraft. First, there is Semipalatinsk, where both underground nuclear tests and particle beam weapon tests are carried out. At Semipalatinsk, the Cosmospheres are assembled and outfitted with their nuclear power plants and particle beam weapons. Then they are transferred 400 miles northeast to the Novosibirsk Science City, where the operational Cosmosphere base is located. The key to the American attack plan for the two Cosmosphere installations is northern Sinkiang Province, China. From there to Novosibirsk, the primary target, it is only 400 miles. And the secondary target, Semipalatinsk, is less than 300 miles distant. The Rockefellers are trying to move heaven and earth to persuade China to open up Sinkiang Province to a secret American attack force. The attack from Sinkiang Province is to be built around very high-speed, remotely piloted airplanes called RPVs, which have been under development for years in both Russia and America. Since the pilot stays behind on the ground and guides the plane by remote control, a RPV is much smaller than an equivalent piloted airplane. It can also perform evasive maneuvers so violent that the pilot would be crushed if he were aboard. Our secret rulers believe that enough of these aircraft can penetrate Russian defenses to ensure destruction of the Siberian Cosmosphere installations. My friends, I have now told you about the strategic objectives and techniques which are being planned for the American first strike against Russia, but you must know about one additional key to this suicidal plan. I refer to the Middle East crisis now building up, which is intended to light the fuse for nuclear war one. A few days from now, the Camp David summit between Sadat of Egypt and Begin of Israel is to get underway. Our secret rulers are trying to ensure that a new Begin will emerge from these meetings to delight the public. Suddenly the hardline attitudes of recent days will seem to evaporate on both sides, much to everyone's surprise. Conciliation and mutual concessions will become the order of the day, and the joyful shouts of peace, peace will ring in our ears. The euphoria surrounding the outcome of the Camp David summit will be like an echo of the high hopes of last November 1977, just after Sadat's trip to Jerusalem. As a result, most of us will pay little attention to the foundation on which all else will rest. Underlying all the smiles and happy words, there's to be an agreement by which American troops will be sent to the Middle East as supposed guarantors of the peace. It will all be made to appear logical and honest, and no one will dare to raise a finger to criticize this plan. But now let me tell you what is really planned, for only if you know the truth will you have any chance to protect yourself in the disastrous days that lie ahead.